Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. And we welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities, or probably more important, your inabilities. Today, our presentation will be given by Ian Riddle, who is right here, and who I knew as the music director at James Reeb Congregation, but he's gone on. He'll be speaking on overwork, work addiction, and the blessings of the Sabbath. Well, I'd like to introduce Ian Riddle. As I said earlier, he for some years was the music director at James Reeb and did a wonderful job with that choir. But he's gone on to become a minister, working toward being one. He just completed this year as a ministerial intern at the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Monterey Peninsula in Carmel, California. And he's returning to Chicago now to complete his final year at Meadville Lombard Theological School. And you know that's the Unitarian Universalist Theological School. This fall, he'll serve as a student minister at the Open Circle Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. So he'll be in Wisconsin instead of California. He's going to do a presentation, a sermon, Overwork, Work Addiction, and the Blessings of the Sabbath. Ian.
Thank you very much. It's really wonderful to be back in the Midwest, although the heat is getting to me. It's probably 70 degrees, 60 degrees in Carmel right now. It was not the year to be out of the Midwest, apparently. We missed the winter of all winters, and it was really fascinating and heartening and sad and really moving to watch this city over the last 6 months from afar, and to watch you on the news, and to be with you in spirit, if not in person. I'm grateful to be back. I've been thinking a lot about work lately, partly because of watching what's happened here in Madison and Wisconsin and issues of labor, but also dealing with friends who are unemployed, with friends who are struggling to make ends meet to feed their families when they are fully employed, and friends who are questioning their relationship to work. And so I've been thinking a lot about work and how we work in our society. And I want to share today with you some of my thoughts, not all of them, some of my thoughts on that theme. And I want to start with a poem by Wendell Berry, one of his Sabbath poems from 1985. How long does it take to make the woods? As long as it takes to make the world. The woods is present as the world is, the presence of all its past and all its time to come. It is always finished. It is always being made, the act of its making forever greater than the act of its destruction. It is part of eternity, for its end and beginning belong to the beginning and end of all things, the beginning lost in the end, and the end in the beginning. What is the way to the woods? How do you go there? By climbing up through the 6 days field kept in all the body's years, the body's sorrow, weariness, and joy. By passing through the narrow gate on the far side of that field where the pasture grass of the body's life gives way to the high original standing of the trees. By coming into the shadow of the grace of the straight ways ending, the shadow of the mercy of light. Why must the gate be narrow? Because you cannot pass beyond it burdened, To come into the woods, you must leave behind the 6 days world. All of it, all of its plans and hopes, you must come without weapon or tool, alone, expecting nothing, remembering nothing, into the ease of sight, the brotherhood of eye and leaf. I want to tell you a story of a couple of old friends of mine, Anne and Dan. Now, Anne and Dan live in Victoria, British Columbia, and they were founding members of the very first congregation I served as music director there, my very first Unitarian Universalist home. Anne and Dan are both university professors in sociology and economics, respectively. They have 3 grown children and have a deep, loving relationship, blessed with intellectual stimulation, humor, and deep companionship. In fact, they were a real model for my partner Mark and me as we were figuring out what the shape of our relationship was to become. But when we first met Anne and Dan, as we got to know them better, things weren't as great as they seemed. True, they had a fabulous home and really exciting careers, but they were coming to a point where they realized that their lives were becoming unwieldy and unhealthy. Teaching loads and commuting and side projects to pay the mortgage on the large house that was miles out of town, now all but empty after their children went to college, all this began to overwhelm them. And they had less and less time for the deep, meaningful conversations that were the core of their marriage and brought great joy to both of their lives. And they began to resent the time that they had committed to giving to the life of their congregation. Anne's health was becoming uncertain, and they both began to feel like they'd come unmoored from their understanding of who they were and why they were doing the work that they once cherished so deeply. Now, Anne and Dan are not alone. In her book, The Overworked American, Juliette Shore observes that, sorry, did everybody else turn their cell phone off? That's not ever happened to me before. It's a first for everything. In the book, The Overworked American, Juliette Shore observes that millions of working parents see their children or spouses far less than they should or would like to. Working mothers complain they have no time for themselves. Volunteer work is on the decline, presumably because people have little time for it. Employed Americans spend long hours at jobs that are adversely affecting their health through injury, occupationally induced disease, and stress. We live in a culture of overwork. Our dominant culture, our dominant society, is steeped in the understanding that our worth grows out of our work, and our identities are encompassed by our jobs. If you don't believe me, watch what happens the first time you meet a new person. How quickly does the question, "What do you do?" come out of your mouth? Think about what that says to a stranger you're greeting. I need to know what you do for a living so I can know who you are. Now, valuing the work of our hands, the sweat of our brows, the creations of our minds is not a bad thing, of course. Our work brings us safety. It brings us survival. And it brings us comfort sometimes. It can bring great satisfaction. Meaningful work can be a great joy in our lives. But just like chocolate, or caffeine, or alcohol, taken to an extreme to the neglect of all other importance, it can become an illness, a danger, an addiction. And it's an addiction that we are quite often honestly celebrated for having in our society. We know what problems in pain, alcohol, and drug dependence can cause for people and their families. We know the damage that addiction to food or gambling can cause. We don't like to know these things, but we do know them. And we make at least some attempts to help those who are afflicted with these dependencies. We hope that our friends and our families will intervene if we stray down those paths. But addiction to work? Workaholics Anonymous, and yes, there is such a thing, outlines the symptoms of work addiction as including deriving our identity and self-esteem from what we do, keeping overly busy, neglecting our health, relationships, and spirituality, seeing everything as work-related, having no desire to do anything, that would be work avoidance or burnout, procrastination, postponing vacations and rest, doing unnecessary work, perfectionism, avoiding intimacy, and being controlling. As a culture, many of us in North America often don't even recognize that there's a problem with the way that we approach and engage with our jobs. No, we relish the fact that we work so hard. People are celebrated for their dedication and selflessness to their work. We believe that hard work is a sign of an upright and proper character. In fact, we get that notion from our Calvinist forebears who lived with the idea that hard work was a sign that you were saved. It reflected your salvation. Now, according to them, it couldn't save whether you were saved or not. It wouldn't change that. But it was an outward sign. Working hard meant that you showed the world that you were one of the elect. Now, partly for that reason, our majority culture and our Unitarian Universalist tradition as well, our culture values action over reflection, activity over passivity. Now, we've rejected so many damaging and destructive parts of that Calvinist theology, but this we keep deep in our cultural center, and so we dive in and we work. We work to overcome doubt. We work to overcome fear. We work to protect ourselves from chaos. We work because we need the approval of the world. We forget that we are enough, that we are loved just as we are. We forget that first principle right there about ourselves. We're living in challenging and uncertain times, I know, and many of us are doing more and more with less and less certainty that we're receiving enough to make it. We're taking care of aging parents, paying off mortgages on houses that are not worth what we owe on them, worrying about how we're going to afford our long retirements, struggling to make ends meet in an economy that threatens us, with governments that don't seem to pay attention to our needs, afraid of what will happen to our families if the plant closes or we lose our health. All of these things drive us. And it would be easy and clean to blame busyness and stress on these trying economic times. But there are many ways into the mire and fracturedness of overwork and loss of center. Many ways in which we, day by day, choice by choice, allow ourselves to lose the anchor of ourselves in the storm of the world's needs. Allow ourselves to often lose sight of why we do any work in the first place. Many individual ways in. What was my path in will not be my neighbor's path or my enemy's path. And there are, of course, many paths out again, many paths to reassessing what we're doing and why we're doing it. One path is to honestly assess what we're receiving for the work that we do and the costs we pay to do that work, costs in stress and commuting and necessary downtime. I watch my friends as they work 80-hour weeks because they have to pay for the house that they think they need for people to approve of them. In the 1990s, Vicki Robin and Joe Dominguez published a book called Your Money or Your Life. And in it, they asked their readers to calculate the actual amount of money their job was bringing in for them for every hour of work. And by actual, they meant taking into account what it costs in time and money and stress to actually get to and from work each day, what it costs to dress for work, what it costs to pay for the vacations, or the medicine, or the therapy that doing that work made necessary, all of that. And many of us have done this assessment and have decided to live with less, downsizing in order to have a different relationship to work and to life. And I have to share a tension with you here. As I worked on this sermon over the summer and spent some time with it, I realized that I'm talking, and the story that I have chosen to tell you of Ann and Dan is a story of people who have the opportunity, who have the option to think about these things, who have the opportunity to make these choices to change their lives. So I want to acknowledge to you my tension around that fact and know that that is only a piece of the story and that there are people who do not have these options to choose, to downsize. There are people who are fighting and struggling to keep any food on the table. And I acknowledge that. And I still think there's a piece in this story for them. Looking at these things is important. Balance, true needs, the effects of our choices around work. But more central for me and more important, I think, to us as a religious community is to understand how we often lose our connection to our deepest needs and deepest meaning when we allow our lives to become dominated by the mode of doing. How we become fractured and scattered. And there are, of course, many paths back out again. Many paths back to the forgotten or neglected center of our being. And these paths form the core of most individual and collective spiritual practices. Prayer, meditation, chanting, ritual dancing, journaling. But I'm coming to understand that central to reclaiming balance and centeredness in our relation to our work, whether we have abundance of work or we're struggling to find it, is the notion of Sabbath. Now we get the word Sabbath through an old English, an old French word, sabbat, which comes from the Latin sabbatum, which comes from the Greek sabbaton, and which comes from the Hebrew word sabbat, which means to cease, to rest. In the Jewish tradition, no work is done on this day, from sunset Friday until the first star can be seen on Saturday evening. No work is done. And in stricter and more orthodox circles, no cooking, no driving. For many scholars, rabbis, and mystics, though, the practice of Sabbath is richer and more important than merely resting. It's not just vacation. Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great rabbi, scholar, and activist of the mid-20th century, deeply revered this ritual of his family, his community. Informed by a rich rabbinical tradition, he saw in it something deeper and more holy than simply rest. For Heschel, the honoring and practicing of the Sabbath shifted our orientation away from the domination of space through work and action to a deeper resonance and celebration of time, which for him was the heart of existence. He says, "The meaning of Sabbath is to celebrate time rather than space. 6 days a week we live under the tyranny of things of space. On the Sabbath, we try to become attuned to the holiness in time. It is a day on which we are called to share in what is eternal in time, to turn from the results of creation to the mystery of creation, from the world of creation to the creation of the world." For Heschel, the Sabbath turns us from the production of the hands to the contemplation and nurturing of the spirit. 6 days a week, he says, we wrestle with the world, wringing profit from the earth. On the Sabbath, we especially care for the seed of eternity planted in the soul. The Sabbath, for Heschel and others, is to invoke harmony between the human and the divine, to develop sympathy with the spirit, in their words, to unite the world with God. It is the true happiness of the universe, he says. Now, Heschel, of course, grew up steeped in a tradition thousands of years old, a tradition in which the community observed a weekly Sabbath. For Jews and for Christians and Muslims after and alongside them, this tradition was not one invented by human beings. For them, it recalls and honors the actions of their creator God in the very first days of the life of the universe. The book of Genesis says, in the Hebrew scriptures, the heaven and the earth were finished, and all their array. And on the seventh day, the creator finished the work that he had been doing, and he ceased on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. And the Creator blessed the seventh day and declared it holy, because on it he had ceased from all the work of creation that he had made. Now, later tradition made rule and regulation concerning commemoration of this seventh day of rest, these rules about work and driving and cooking. But at heart, it was seen as a gift to humanity, a reminder that our lives are not all work. In returning and rest, you shall be saved, the prophet Isaiah said, speaking for his God. In quietness and trust shall be your strength. Taking the Sabbath as a day to rest and reflect and relocate themselves in time is a powerful ritual. But other Sabbaths, briefer practices or longer retreats, also feed us. My friends Anne and Dan found that taking time together each day to walk with each other and share silence together restored the connection to each other that they'd felt slipping away, even in the midst of all their work. Anne returned to her practice of taking a solo retreat now and again. These practices didn't make them better at doing their job or at their relationship, but they helped them be more grounded and centered in their own being, their own connections to deeper reality, to understand the love in which they were held, so that when they came together, when they engaged in their work, they were whole and freer to embrace what came their way. The poet Wendell Berry, over the past few decades, has engaged in the practice of writing poems on the Sabbath after church, often written out of doors during or after a silent, solitary walk. The poems, he says, are about moments when heart and mind are open and aware. The poem I shared earlier today was written by Berry in 1985, a Sabbath poem about Sabbath, a poem about the necessity of doing the work of our 6 days, doing the work of the world. But in order to pass through the narrow gate, he says, we must leave behind the 6 days world and its plans and hope, leave them behind, if only for a time, so that we can truly just see. You must come without weapon or tool alone, he says, expecting nothing, remembering nothing, into the ease of sight, the brotherhood and eye and leaf. And so I ask, I pray, that you, that we, whether we have too much work or not enough, whether we struggle to put food on the table each night or struggle to find time in our day to spend time with our family, that we will find a way to find the time to pause, to regularly leave behind that 6 days world and its plans and its hopes, to breathe, if only for a moment, to enter with Rabbi Heschel that realm where the goal is not to have, but to be, not to own, but to give, not to control, but to share, not to subdue, but to be in accord, where we can hear that still, small voice, where we can stop the bump, bump, bump of our head down the stairs just for a moment to see a different way, perhaps, to feel the breath of the Spirit moving through us, to remember who it is you are and why you choose to do the things you do. Not so that you can do them better or more efficiently, but so that you can thrive and engage them and be free as you do the chosen work of your life. May it be so. Yeah. I have my roommate, actually, who works in downtown Chicago, works. He leaves home about 6 o'clock and gets home about 8 o'clock, 5 days a week. And thankfully, he can scrape out a weekend. But, you know, when we question him and we're worried about him because he's killing himself. It's too much. And he says, well, I have a job. I'm grateful. And this is the new normal. You know, in his line of work, 60 to 80 hours a week is what is just the expected standard. And so, you know, I think he feels deeply grateful that he has work. And he is. And it's killing him. And so there's that tension, I think, that shift. Our work is our work becomes our identity. And not having work, I mean, I have a dear close friend who was unemployed for, as many of you probably do, unemployed for a long time. And the stress he felt was not just about putting food on the table, because he was lucky and able to do that. But the stress he felt was, well, who am I without work? And it added to his stress. And the stress of not having work was enough. I mean, the stress of worrying about getting food on the table is enough without that added sort of spiritual questioning that our society, I think, it reinforces with our ways of I am this, I am that.